This is Jamie Floyd in for Brian Lehrer today on WNYC. Since 1973, Roe versus Wade has been the standard, the law of the land when it comes to abortion in this country. The right to privacy and the extension of that right to pregnant women making decisions about their health was established in that case. No law can restrict a woman's access to an abortion in the early months of her pregnancy, the U.S. Supreme Court decided. But nearly 30 years later, there are a few headlines from around the country. Governor Fallon signs bill restricting abortions. That's the Tulsa World of Oklahoma. Limits on abortion clear funding from the Journal-Gazette of Indiana. Abortion amendment faces Senate vote. That's WSMV-TV in Nashville, Tennessee. And the headlines go on and on. Over 900 restrictions have been introduced into state legislatures in just 2011. And one by one, the laws on the state level have changed the landscape of abortion rights in the United States. The recent congressional battle over Planned Parenthood funding isn't the only place where this fight is brewing. But one place it is not likely to surface is in the U.S. Supreme Court. Joining me now to talk about some of these new state laws and why pro-choice advocates have been hesitant to take the issue back to the courts is Dahlia Lithwick, senior editor at Slate, who wrote about this story this week. Welcome back to WNYC.
Thank you, Jamie.
Well, this is a really fascinating issue. Why are there all of these restrictions that we are talking about in these state laws? And I know that's a big, broad question, having read your piece. But give us the broad landscape, and then we'll start to pick apart your story piece by piece.
Okay. Well, the easy answer is that this has been happening for quite some time, where opponents of abortion have determined that the soft spot here is the states, that the Supreme Court, not clear what they're going to do, but we can really, really push these quite aggressively anti-choice measures in the states, often with the purpose of forcing the issue in the courts. In other words, there's a lot of rhetoric of, let's see where Anthony Kennedy is these days. He's the swing vote at the court. Or there's new science that suggests that Roe is wrong, so let's push it. So there just seems to be a sense in the states that this is the place for action. And so, as you said, you know, not only have there been 916 measures in all 49 states since the 2010 election, but there's also been a big shift in terms of the number of pro-life governors who were elected. It went from 21 to 29 in the last election, and the number of states where the governor and the legislature agree has ticked up. So there just seems to be a feeling that the time is ripe to test Roe, and we're going to do it in the states.
Well, way back when I was in law school, so that's 20 years ago, just 10 years after the Roe decision, why it seemed then that the abortion debate was a big, hot, heated debate. People were marching in Washington and on both sides of the issue and standing in front of abortion clinics. And how can all this change be happening and the public not be on fire on both sides of the issue? Where is the public opinion on the issue? Has it changed much since 1973? And if so, or if not, why not?
It's really interesting. If you look at the polling, weirdly, public opinion is almost exactly consistent with what it was after Roe, which is to say a majority of people still think that abortion should be legal under some circumstances. There's been a tiny uptick in the number of people who self-identify as pro-life, but really it's at the margins that people have these extreme views that abortion should be, you know, legal all the time under all circumstances, or alternatively, no one should ever be able to have an abortion. So the really interesting piece of this story to me is that even though public opinion hasn't changed, legislators have become emboldened in a way that we haven't seen before. Also, don't forget, and this is just an interesting side note, in 1992, when the court was revisiting this issue in Casey versus Planned Parenthood, I think almost everybody who watched the court thought that was going to be the moment that Roe would be struck down. going into that decision, it was a real surprise, this strange threesome of Justices Souter, David Souter, Anthony Kennedy, and Sandra Day O'Connor came together at the very last minute for reasons we still actually don't know what those reasons were, but came together to preserve the heart of Roe. So really, I think there was a sense in 1992 that the days of Roe were numbered, and that decision was a surprise. So it's not entirely true that we didn't think this was going to happen before. We did think it was going to happen. Casey preserved it. I think what we're seeing now is just another wave of that same sentiment that this time the Supreme Court really is ready to flip on Roe.
And while pro-choice advocates have been focused on preserving Roe in the courts and certainly at the high court level, your article suggests that at the state level, pro-right activists have been chipping away at Roe in very creative ways, very specific ways. Can you give, and you've just suggested it in your last answer as well, can you give some examples in the various states of ways in which the right to abortion is limited?
Absolutely. And the Guttmacher Institute, which is a nonpartisan issue research institution that studies the litigation and the legislation, has just published a big report saying that there are 15 new laws passed in seven states just in the past year alone. And they range from things like extending the waiting period from 24 hours to longer, to 72 hours in some cases, providing mandatory counseling. So there's a law now that suggests that you have to go to a, quote, crisis prevention center, a pregnancy prevention center, where you will get counseling. And this is different from Planned Parenthood because the counseling tends to be based in religion. And there's some question about whether all the counseling is factual. In other words, there's data about the risk of suicide that has been questioned by various medical associations. There's a whole raft of new laws suggesting that women have to view ultrasounds. They have to have a doctor read from a script about this is a baby, these are its fingers. So there's all sorts of things. And here in Virginia, where I live, there's been real restrictions on abortion centers that they now have to be regulated like hospitals, not like places that, you know, do other sorts of surgeries, but like hospitals. And that may result in the closing of many, many, many centers. So it's all around the margins. What's important is nobody says Roe is no longer the law. What they do is either under the guise of counseling or under the guise of asking women to think really hard about what they're doing, force them to have conversations or to look at ultrasounds or force them to wait longer and longer and longer. It's all really, I think, a response, and this is important, to a shift that we see in Justice Kennedy's thinking in a 2007 case where he starts to say women are going to have regrets. And so a lot of these measures are ways of saying we don't want women to have regrets, so we're going to just give them more counseling, more ultrasounds, more information, and then they'll know what they're really doing.
So is it fair to say, Dahlia, that there is hesitation on the part of pro-choice advocates in the courts because they think they can't win? Is there a legal strategy at work, or is that not a fair statement?
You know, it depends who you ask. And one of the reasons this was a tough piece to write is that a lot of the pro-choice groups say, oh, no, you know, we don't jump when the pro-life groups legislate. We're not following their agenda. We're doing what we're doing. We're fighting these laws in the courts. We're just focused on different things. So there is, I think, some suggestion that nothing has changed. Sarah Cliff has a really good piece in Politico yesterday that I would commend to your listeners, where she makes essentially the same point that I make, which is, yes, there is some hesitation because there is some real question. For instance, Nebraska a year ago passed a law that shifted the goalposts. So said instead of viability, which was always the standard after Roe, right? No abortion after the fetus is viable could survive outside the womb. And that number has shifted down to 20 weeks in Nebraska, not not predicated on viability, but predicated on the idea that a fetus feels pain. And you may recall in Ohio, they had hearings on this where they actually had fetal, quote, testimony, where they listened to ultrasounds right in the legislature and said, you know, this is the fetus testifying. So again, this effort to shift it, not based on viability, but based on the idea that a fetus feels pain, that new medical science that didn't exist at the time of Roe suggests we need to move the line. That was passed in Nebraska a year ago and still not been challenged in the courts. Again, I think because there is some feeling that there may well be five votes, certainly at the U.S. Supreme Court level, for upholding a ban like that, for saying dignity and viability have changed.
We had, of course, the Planned Parenthood debate over the budget. You mentioned the court. We have Kennedy in the center and the constant thought that we may end up back there on abortion. Of course, Oklahoma's governor signed two bills into law yesterday related to abortion. Where do you see the next debate on the issue, the next real major debate in the states, in the Supreme Court, in Congress?
Well, it's an interesting problem. I think that everyone really does agree on both sides that all the action is happening in the states. I think there were five or six abortion-related bills passed in Florida alone. So, you know, the states are pushing very, very hard on this. And as I said, sometimes promoting these very, very novel ideas, like viability isn't the line anymore, now we're going to test for when fetal pain begins. And as I said, sometimes pushing the idea that we know now that mothers have deep, deep, deep bonds with their fetus and profound regrets after an abortion. There's a huge increase, they argue, in the chance of suicide and depression. And so we're going to make sure moms don't get depressed. So those kinds of laws are getting passed all over the states. And I think that it's in the Supreme Court's interest, and this is what I argued in my piece, not to get involved. In other words, the Supreme Court doesn't want to be the place that Roe gets overturned. I think that public opinion still supports abortion in some circumstances. So I think what the court gets to do now is hang back and watch states pass bans. After Nebraska passed its fetal pain law, 17 other states passed copycat laws. If nobody challenges these in a state, not only did they become law, effectively law in that state, but 17 other states say, hey, Nebraska passed it and nothing bad happened to them. Let's do it too. So I think we're going to see a huge surge, not just in this kind of legislation at the state level, but a huge surge in states saying, well, if fetal pain is the new standard, we're going to try for fetal pain. And that will have the effect of hollowing out Roe v. Wade without the court having to lift a finger.
And we will never get to a point, Dahlia, will we, that this becomes purely a scientific matter and not at all a political matter, correct? I mean, this will always be a political matter to some extent. Am I right? We can't envision a day way off in the future where we can answer these questions entirely through science.
I think that's right. And in some sense, that was the flaw of the original Roe decision.
That's where I was going with my question. I was trying to ask it in a way that wouldn't garner a whole lot of phone calls.
No, I mean, I think that Roe was rooted in science, rooted in these ideas of what medicine knew at the time, and obviously that has changed. And even I think it's fair to say, and maybe this is also the underpinning of your question, that the line for viability has changed.
That's precisely it. The line for viability, if you could ever draw it, would have shifted since then.
I think that's right. But I think there's another strain here that's really interesting. It's not just that science has changed. It's that now there is, each side has its own studies. And so if you look, for instance, at Justice Kennedy's opinion, the decisive fifth vote in Carhartt versus Gonzalez, that's the 2000, quote, partial birth abortion decision, Justice Kennedy roots his feeling that women are going to have regrets and that they are going to need to think harder about this in a whole bunch of quote, science that was wildly discredited at the time, science that suggested that the numbers of women who commit suicide or suffer severe depression, that Those studies have been debunked widely by almost anyone who's looked at them as a matter of real scientific data. And so I think the real question here isn't just that we're never going to agree on the science. I think the profound problem here is that there's our science and your science. And we no longer even agree, for instance, this fetal pain study, the same thing. It's been debunked by, you know, one medical association after another, but it doesn't matter anymore. It doesn't matter whose study you use. Each side believes their study is true. Each side believes the other side's science is wrong. And I think that's the real question we're going to have. We're never going to come to agree, not just on the medical line. We don't even agree on the studies.
But it really does then point out how significant, as we all know, the president's appointments are to the U.S. Supreme Court. And when the justices, or I guess I would say the nominees, of either party go before the Senate Judiciary Committee and ultimately before the full body for a vote, but when they go before the committee and suggest that they have not yet thought through the Roe decision and all of the issues that we are talking about, not to mention any other significant Supreme Court jurisprudence, it has to be, Dahlia, disingenuous. And I say that with all due respect to the recent nominees who have since been confirmed, because of course they have, because each vote matters so significantly on this case.
That's so right, and I think it's so apt to remind listeners that the signal moment in abortion jurisprudence in the last couple of years comes when Sandra Day O'Connor, remember she was in that plurality, in that majority in Casey to uphold the core principle of Roe, she's replaced by Samuel Alito, who votes against the continued existence of Roe in the partial birth abortion case. And so I think that the thing that's really critical here is that somebody who was Sandra Day O'Connor, who believed, I think, exactly what most Americans believed, the right to abortion with limits and constraints, is gone from the court, and that shifts the ground forever. And so it's really just one appointment changes everything. The fact that Justice Kennedy may have changed his mind is a piece of that, and certainly a huge piece of this looking forward is both sides trying to guess what's happening in Justice Kennedy's mind. But I think your core point is exactly right, which is presidential appointments matter, and we have these five-day circus confirmation hearings in which we say to the nominee, look, here's something you wrote, Samuel Alito, saying that you think Roe was wrongly decided. What do you think today? Oh, I can't answer that, Judiciary Committee, because it might come before me. So I think you're quite right that the falsity of the claim that someone has never thought about it is compounded by the falsity of the claim that they can't answer. And so really, the theater of these confirmation hearings obscures more than it clarifies.
Well, we'll have you back for the next round of confirmation hearings. My guest has been Dahlia Lithwick, senior editor at Slate.com. Thank you for being with us and for your wonderful piece on Roe v. Wade.
Thank you for having me.
I'm Jamie Floyd in for Brian Lehrer. We'll be right back.